Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many narcissists do you know? People who assume they are more important than everybody else and more entitled to praise and special treatment are all over the headlines, from politicians to celebrities to flashy corporate bigwigs. In fact, by the most conservative estimates, at least one in every 100 people exhibits behaviors associated with narcissistic personality disorder. That means just about everybody has to interact with a narcissist at least occasionally, and we may find ourselves charmed and dazzled by them before we're left worn out and disappointed. Jeffrey Kluger is editor-at-large at Time and Time.com. His new book is The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You open the book with an essay on Donald Trump, and this might sound like a rhetorical question, but what about him suggests that he might suffer from narcissistic personality disorder?
Well, I would say that whole endowed chairs at some point will be devoted to studying the narcissistic phenomenon that is Donald Trump. Everything about him, his grandiosity, his lack of perspective, his need to stamp his name on virtually everything that he builds, his intolerance for criticism, his preening dress and prose, the hyperbole with which he describes himself, even the way he stands with his hands on his hips and his jacket flared open. This is, you should pardon the image, but this is very much a great ape fitness display with all of the unseemly things that go with that.
But after a bit of fun at Trump's expense, you do point out that narcissists suffer from needing that constant adulation and affirmation. They're not necessarily the happiest people among us.
No, that's right. And I think that's an important point. I mean, you mentioned narcissistic personality disorder, which affects only 1 to 3% of the population. But there are gradations of it well below that, what I call lowercase n narcissism. And in all these cases, the word disorder applies. The disordered mind isn't a happy mind. It's not a mind that's content with itself. So much of narcissism is built around a consuming need for validation, a consuming need for applause and attention and rewards and recognition. And, you know, we all love that, but there's a certain substance abuse quality to it. We all may love good wine, but, you know, if you're driven by a need to consume wine all the time, we call that alcoholism.
So a person who is functional and not narcissistic can enjoy a compliment or someone's admiration, but a person who is narcissistic really has to have that even just to function and get through the day?
That's right. Well, yes. Again, it depends on the gradations of narcissism. It depends on the particular expression of narcissism. But it's not at all too much to say that people who fall in most spots on the narcissism scale are uncomfortable unless they're being validated. They're uncomfortable unless they're being rewarded. They go out and seek those kinds of rewards and recognition. And if they do something that they think is recognition worthy, such as make a very good point in a meeting at work, and don't get the applause they think they deserve, they feel very aggrieved and bereft over that. There's a certain sense of entitlement. I said or did a smart thing, and therefore applause should be forthcoming.
And it's interesting because in our culture, it's really easy to say, well, I'm not narcissistic. I'm just very ambitious, or I am trying to live up to my dreams and never give up. It's easy to say it's something other than narcissism.
Well, that's right. And an important element in the book, and I try to make this not just in the book but in the other writings that I've been doing on narcissism, is that we all need an element of narcissism to succeed. It can be very bracing. It can embolden us. If you have a good idea, if you're an innovative person, if you're Steve Jobs who has a brainstorm about how to, you know, build the personal computer and take it out of the hands only of the experts, but you don't have the confidence and indeed the cockiness to step forward and say, yes, this is a good idea, and I'm the person that can make it happen, and I have that monomaniacal commitment to this goal that's necessary to make it happen. And I refuse to see failure as an option. I see only success as an option because I'm that good. Well, I mean, in that case, we should be grateful that Steve Jobs was a narcissist.
We just don't have to live with him.
Well, yes. And I mean, I do spend a fair amount of time writing about Jobs in the book. And he was known to be an extraordinarily difficult person to work with. But the great conundrum of Jobs and other people like him is that when even the people that he offended or hurt or bullied the most were asked, they would readily concede the point he was making was a good one. He was criticizing me deservedly, and he made me do a better job. He just went about it in the worst possible way.
So there's this index, this measurement device called the Narcissistic Personality Index. Can you tell us, and you include it in the book, can you tell us about some of the questions that are on there?
Well, some of the questions on there are pretty straightforward, and they really are. You're asked to choose between 40 pairs of statements, and some of them are clearly opposite each other. One of them says, you know, I like to be the center of attention, and, you know, the opposite choice says being the center of attention makes me uncomfortable. Okay, that's a pretty binary choice. Some of them say things equally binary. If I ran the world, it would be a better place, and the alternative is running the world scares the hell out of me. But others are a little more ambiguous. They're a little shadier because it may say I'm more capable than most people I know, and then the alternative might be there is a lot I can learn from other people. Well, both of those things can be true. You may be more capable than most people, but you may be humble enough to know that you can learn a lot from other people. But the NPI is what's called a forced choice test. So you're required, if you're going to take the test and comply by the rules, to go through all 40 questions and check the answer on each one that most closely applies to you. When these are added up, they yield your narcissistic personality inventory score. Now, in the U.S., the average score is somewhere between 15 and 16, depending on age, education, a whole lot of other ranges. You don't have to get very high, very far from that 16 to be considered pathological. In some prisons, in the California state prison system, inmates convicted of violent crimes who are narcissistic in the extreme because they truly don't care about the other people around them score a 23. In Massachusetts, violent criminals score about a 21. The most narcissistic celebrities score about 19.5. So it's a very fine range of scores that makes a very big difference in temperament.
So is the United States a more narcissistic culture than others?
Well, we have the luxury of being more narcissistic because for a few reasons. First of all, we were a reasonably comfortable country for most people. We're a reasonably wealthy country for most people compared to, obviously, most of the rest of the world. Therefore, we're not – these survival questions, subsistence questions have long since been taken off the table for us. We do reward narcissistic behavior more than most countries. This whole idea of individualism, this whole idea of the American dream and the American striver, certainly the way we have idealized and, to hear some people tell it, fetishized almost accomplishment and wealth, not only does it forgive and permit narcissism, it almost requires it if you're going to achieve. And we also indulge it. We indulge it with reality TV. We indulge it with the internet. We indulge it with selfies. We indulge it in a whole lot of ways that may not be responsible for narcissism. But as I say in the book, it's a little bit providing the kind of social media that allows us to advertise ourselves is to the narcissist a little bit like the open bar is to a drunk. It's just, a much quicker way to get the substance you're probably going to be abusing anyway.
There are three subtypes of narcissism, the power people, the special person people, and the grandiose exhibitionist people. Can you talk about how they're different from one another?
Well, the power people are people like Trump. The power people are people who come to power either through bullying, through innate wealth, in the case of someone like Steve Jobs, through a special skill. But they can also be people who come to power because of a special skill that we admire, even venerate. Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, I cite in the book, as extraordinarily powerful people who projected a great humility because they were, but another dimension of their personalities had to mean narcissism. It had to be not only the willingness to stand up before a crowd, but a certain pleasure they got from it, that you don't become the people they were without a certain love for that kind of adulation. Now, we don't see it in the two of them because they both balanced it with a lot of humility. We see it much more in the case of Bill Clinton, who is, you know, he's at least Donald Trump's narcissistic equal in terms of narcissistic octane, though he's a much more appealing character. The special person category are the people who, as their name suggests, either are special or simply believe themselves special. And with that specialness or self-perceived specialness comes a sense of entitlement. I am entitled to other things. The rules don't apply to me because I'm a unique person, because I bring something to the table that other people don't. And the third category, forgive me, I don't have them listed in front of me. What was the third one you said?
My favorite term, grandiose exhibitionist.
Oh, grandiose exhibitionistic. Forgive me. Yes. Grandiose exhibitionistic is exactly what it seems like it is. You see this in a lot of celebrities. You see this in a lot of show people who aren't necessarily celebrities, people who, you know, the person who loves to get up at a meeting and make the largest, grandest points and be the one in the spotlight, the raconteur at a party who isn't necessarily as good a raconteur as he thinks he is, but he needs to hold the spotlight. The grandiosity component there is that sense of I am larger than life. I'm a more vivid personality than anyone in the room. Even if I'm not bringing an innate power to it, even if I'm not bringing an innate skill to it, I am bringing a largeness of temperament, and that makes me special.
And they will find something about who they are that no one else can match. Basically.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I cite Jimmy Kane, who was the former head of Bear Stearns, who was obviously one of the people who helped drive Bear Stearns into the ground, who happened to be a very good bridge player. And early in his career, when he was a young man at Bear Stearns, he was quoted as saying to a superior something along the lines of, if you play bridge for the rest of your life, if you achieve the best, your greatest potential and play with the greatest players in the world, you will never be as good a bridge player as I am. And he said this during his job interview. So this tells us, and this wasn't even what he was being hired for. He was being hired to be an asset manager and an investor. But he knew this about himself, and there was a certain truth to it. He was known to be a great bridge player and probably still is. But the point is, he couldn't resist advertising that about himself.
You know, we've all been cornered like at a cocktail party or something by somebody who feels the need to tell us all their accomplishments that we may or may not be interested in. And I wonder if part of the problem is that most people are too polite to say, I don't really want to hear this about you anymore. Let's talk about something else.
Well, that is a piece of it. You know, most of us do want to run screaming from the room when somebody corners us like that. And it's very, very hard to try to find a crack of conversational daylight and talk about yourself. And if you do find it, it's quickly slammed shut because no matter what you say, the person you're talking to, the narcissist, will flip it back to him or herself and just resume with barely a speed bump. But the other part of it is that narcissists aren't always bores. Narcissists don't always make your eyes glaze over. And that's where the diabolical power of narcissism comes from, because they often are the most charismatic people in the room. They often are the funniest, most charming people in the room. They may not be the smartest. They may not have the biggest fund of knowledge, but they know how to parlay what they have in ways that are captivating to other people. Now, you do meet a lot of people like that who are not narcissists, who are funny and charismatic and charming. And, you know, they're nice people, too. And those are, you've That's a gold mine. That's a terrific person to get to know. In the case of narcissists, you get that sugar buzz of the dynamic personality at first, and then slowly over time you begin to realize that this relationship that could or should be more substantive than this is about no more than this other person performing.
Got to jump in. Jeffrey Kluger is with us. We're talking about The Narcissist Next Door.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
A lot of people think they're geniuses, and nobody says it because it's weird to say it, but it is most certainly more honest to say, I am a genius.
I'm totally weird, and I'm totally honest, and I'm totally inappropriate sometimes. And the thing is, for me to say I wasn't a genius, I would just be lying to you and to myself.
That is Kanye West on the Jimmy Kimmel Show talking about his genius. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Kluger, editor-at-large at Time and Time.com, and author of the new book, The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So what are we to do with Mr. Kanye West, Jeffrey? On the one hand, he is incredibly talented. On the other hand, there's something, it makes us uncomfortable to hear him saying it out loud, but would it be false modesty if he didn't think he was a genius?
Well, no, it wouldn't be false modesty, because you can be modest and be honestly modest. You can be a genius and know you're a genius, but also be modest enough to realize you're part of a world in which your genius is only a small slice of the available kinds of genius. And even if you're Kanye West and extraordinary, there are other geniuses out there who make a much larger contribution to the survival and well-being of the species than you do. And once you maintain that kind of awareness, you find a comfortable place for your talent, for your grandness, or for your grandiosity. I wrote about Kanye West just last week on Time.com and called him the narcissist of the day for that moment in Sydney, Australia 2 weeks ago when he refused to go on with his concert until every single person in the audience stood and held up the show because two people didn't stand. But the thing was, they couldn't stand. One of them was in a wheelchair and one of them had an artificial leg.
Oh, my goodness.
And he would not resume the show until the woman with the artificial leg waved her prosthesis over her head. Now, the thing about the kind of narcissism, and I cite him in the book also for calling himself the Steve Jobs of downtown, the Steve Jobs of music. He's the man who interrupted Taylor Swift's acceptance speech for one of her Grammys because he, Kanye, believed that the wrong person had won. Well, who in the world are you to seize this young girl's moment in the spotlight in order to make your larger point about the fact that Beyonce should have won? But the thing about him is what he just said on Jimmy Kimmel's show is not atypical of narcissists. There's a study that came out not all that long ago that determined that the very best way to ask somebody to find out if someone is a narcissist is ask, and they will actually tell you yes. And the reason is they're thinking as well, just as Kanye just said, I'm extraordinary, and I am the most talented person in the room and maybe the most talented person you'll ever meet. And wouldn't it be disingenuous not to say that? Well, no, it wouldn't be disingenuous. It's frankly pretentious to say it.
Before we talk about nature or nurture producing narcissists, I guess it's reasonable to point out the fact that we're essentially all born as narcissists.
That's right. And it's a benign kind of narcissism. It's a necessary kind of narcissism. But the fact is, babies are perhaps nature's purest expression of narcissism. They take without giving anything back. They take without even an awareness that anyone's giving them anything at all. They are absolutely intolerant of their needs not being met. They feel not just entitled but cheated if they don't get what it is they want to get. And they will literally hurt people to get it. Toddlers will hit other babies over the head with whatever they have handy in order to get the toy from them because they want the toy and because they don't even perceive that the blow to the head that hurts them would feel the same way to the other child. Now, this in an adult would be sociopathically narcissistic, but in the case of a child, it's the only thing they know and it's the only way they can stay alive. A baby that didn't scream in that ear-splitting way that guarantees its needs will be met immediately would be a baby that would be less likely to get fed and would languish and die. So we are hardwired to be as demanding as possible. As we get older, of course, we learn valuable lessons. Kids become socialized in daycare. They become socialized even in early toddlerhood when they realize there are certain things you're allowed, there are certain things you're not allowed. We become socialized to learn that want is not the same as need, and on and on and on through adulthood, so we eventually find a comfortable, collaborative place for ourselves in the world.
So I think back to my own life, and at age 8 or 10, you know, I suppose I felt like I was very special and important. And I honestly believe that, like, Catholic school helped to beat that out of me, not literally, but, you know, the idea
right.
that you're not so special and, you know, take your place in line. When things go right and people grow up not to be narcissists, is that the product of having it removed and people who become narcissists somehow skipped having someone come along and put them in their place?
Well, that's one of those questions with several parts, and the answer to all of them is yes, even if they seem contradictory.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is, look, there is a genetic component to this. You know, one of the studies I looked at of identical twins suggested that there was a 77% heritability in narcissism. Another suggested 64%, but in both cases, we are well over half. But it's important to remember that heritability is just a tendency. That doesn't mean that there is a narcissistic gene, and if you have it, you will be a narcissist. There is a whole lot of other intervening experience. It is true that being brought up with a combination of self-esteem and humility is what's necessary, and most people do get that, either through a combination often of parents who have a pretty good idea of what they're doing, a school system that has a pretty good idea of what they're doing, and a world that's kind of hardwired to reward hard work and punish overreaching. So we've all set up, whether we know it or not, set up a system to bring out the most collaborative elements of ourselves and to keep narcissism at least in check. But your personal circumstances and your personal tendency, your personal predisposition from the womb will help shape that. Catholic school, a lot of people say, makes a difference there, as does the military, as do the Boy Scouts, any kind of organizational system that focuses heavily on discipline and also on making sure people don't get above themselves. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that strict.
You mentioned heritability, and that is something that we ought to discuss because it turns out narcissists are pretty successful at finding people to have sex with them.
They are. And I often say that narcissists, it's one of the reasons narcissism will never be tweezed out of the gene pool, because narcissists do the one thing you have to do to ensure a trait survives, which is they breed a lot. They will literally charm the pants off you and leave a whole lot of little narcissists behind. And that's the danger of narcissists, because they are literally seductive people in these cases. You meet somebody in a bar or at a party, you are dazzled by the fact that this is a person who is so charismatic and so smart and so engaging and has focused that attention on you. There's a sort of I'm not worthy feeling to that. They are often the most attractive people in the room, physically attractive, not necessarily because they, in any abstract or objective way, are traditionally gorgeous, but as much because they get the most out of their physical appearance, both by, you know, knowing what their strengths are and playing those strengths up, and also by just projecting a confidence and an ease, which we all find attractive, and that sort of sloshes over into physical attractiveness. The problem, of course, is those relationships are very one-sided. What you once found charming, what you once found engaging, becomes exhausting. The person who talks a great deal, you suddenly realize, is not listening at all. One of the best tests of someone who may have dated a narcissist is after the first date or two, ask them, you know, how'd the conversation go last night? And the person will often say, oh, it was great. We connected wonderfully. I'd never felt this close. I never felt more like we had an exchange, like I exchanged so much with somebody. And then when you say, how many words did you speak last night? They'll suddenly realize they did almost no talking at all. They did a great deal of listening, but the narcissist is so good that he or she leaves you with a belief that this has really been a reciprocal conversation.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Milton on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Hi there. I was calling in regards to, I had a friendship with a gentleman who, for 30 years, who's actually now in a nursing home, but I'm sure he was a narcissist through and through. One of the things that used to bother me the most was, the fact that no matter what I was doing, what he was doing was much more important. And as an example of that, I got a new job, and it was an important job. And the person coming into his house to put in a new mirror, would you believe? he said, you know, I can't talk to you now. you know, this afternoon he's coming in, and the whole conversation would end up talking around his mirror.
It's pretty textbook, it sounds like. And the fact that it's a mirror is really poetically beautiful.
It really is. That captures it gorgeously. And that is the thing about narcissists. For a narcissist, applause and recognition is a finite quantity. It's a zero-sum game. So while we all may, if your job was in field A and my job is in field B and we both got great contributions, we both got great promotions, my promotion does not detract from your promotion. My recognition does not detract from your recognition. For a narcissist, it's more like I often think of when I, you know, when my kids were smaller and I would cut a cupcake in half or cut a cookie in half and have them share it. Well, every millimeter of cookie that goes to one girl's half is subtracted from the other girl's half. So they will howl like wounded cats at any perceived inequity. Narcissists don't realize that there's plenty of cookies out there. They see the whole world as a single cookie, and if anyone else gets any piece of it, they're being denied something. That, I think, is why the friend is incapable of saying, hey, fantastic work. I want to hear about this new promotion, and when I'm done hearing it, I'll pay attention to my mirror.
So, Jeffrey, kids of our children's generation tend to spend a lot less time in unstructured play situations than we did. How might that affect the development of narcissistic tendencies?
That's a really good question. And I devote a significant passage of the book talking about the work of an investigator named Paul Gray, who looks at that. He looks at play. And the very good point he makes is that unstructured play breeds an ability or fosters an ability to work and engage with other people. Because think about this. If you and I and a bunch of other people are on a softball team and it's a pickup team and there's a lot of other kids on the team, if I throw a tantrum about something, there's a chance I'm going to be banished from the game. On the other hand, if I'm a great player and I take advantage of the weak kids who come up to bat and throw at them really hard so that they're out quickly and they don't really get a chance to enjoy the game, they can pick up and leave. So the game, one way or another, if you misbehave, you'll be banished from the game. If you mistreat other people, they'll quit the game and the game falls apart. We don't see this in structured activities. You are taught in Little League that every out counts. You are taught in Little League that winning is more important, even if what you're told in theory is that sportsmanship is more important. Winning is more important than anything else. With adults there, the game will go on no matter what. In the case of free play, kids have to learn to socialize. They have to learn to immerse themselves into the larger whole. Otherwise, there will be no larger whole to play with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Yvette in Dallas. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about narcissism in athletes. How can narcissism affect the success of athletes, and are they more resilient to the effects of failure because of their narcissism?
That's a great question in a lot of directions. Narcissism can affect the performance of athletes, and if it's narcissism that's held well in check, that's a good thing. By that, I mean you are a performer when you're an athlete, and if you are not highly motivated for that roar of applause, if you don't respond with a reward sense in your brain every time you do something very well, you're going to be less motivated than the person on the opposite side of in your role on the opposite team, who's driven in a way in a deeper and more profound way than you are. The problem is, if you're overly motivated by that, you get into the situation that athletes call dogging it. We saw this with Randy Moss, the receiver for the Minnesota Vikings and a few other teams, who would literally take off plays sometimes. He would just walk through plays if the pass wasn't clearly coming in his direction. It's what's called social loafing. If there's no chance for me to get the glory, if there's no chance for me to do the touchdown dance, I'm not interested and I'm not going to help the rest of the team. In terms of resilience, it depends on the kind of narcissist you are. If you're like Derek Jeter, who, I mean, granted, Derek Jeter is being venerated this week, but, you know, at some level he should be. He's a man who took a lot of failure in the years the Yankees didn't win. Every season they're going to lose 40% or so of their games. So he was confident enough to go out and play and play and play day after day after day. But also modest enough to know that victories aren't guaranteed. The other part of athletes and narcissism is that we tend to breed narcissists among athletes, and one of the reasons is these are one of the key features of narcissism is a belief that the rules don't apply to you. Well, in the case of a lot of athletes, the rules don't apply to them. They've come up through college. They've come up through high school. They've never actually had to even attend some of the classes they took in order to get a passing grade. Then they go on to the pros and sign an eight-figure signing bonus before they've even done a day's work for the team that just hired them. So we breed this sense that they're outside the rules.
My guest is Jeffrey Kluger. He is editor-at-large at Time and Time.com. His new book is called The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
In Think Like a Champion, I've been asked, and I think perhaps I've really wanted to be a little bit more reflective of myself. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's of no interest, but a lot of people seem to be interested. And I think the reason they're interested is they want that certain attitude that it takes for success. So I've really been very introspective in a big way, more so than any other book I've written. And a lot of people, especially reviewers, they've seen it and they really like it.
The inimitable Donald Trump. My guest for the hour is Jeffrey Kluger, editor-at-large at Time and Time.com and author of The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. Jeffrey, if people are dealing with phobias or OCD or depression, they might experience a period of denial, but they are apt to go looking for help eventually. If you are a narcissist and you believe that you are more special than everybody else, are you ever going to seek help for this?
Well, that's a very good question. And that difference between the anxiety disorders and the personality disorders can be really telling. Anxiety disorders are what psychologists call egocentric. That basically means you know they're crazy. You know, if you have OCD, you know it makes no sense to wash your hands 30 times a day. If you're phobic about spiders, you know that there's not going to be a giant spider in the elevator every time you get inside. But you can't get a grip on those feelings. So when people with anxiety disorders go to doctors, they say, this is crazy behavior, please help me fix it. People with personality disorders, in those cases, actually that's for the anxiety disorders, it's called ego dystonic. For personality disorders, it's called ego syntonic, which means that the person who has paranoid personality disorder really does believe people are after him. The person who has histrionic personality disorder really does believe that there is a reason for hyperbolic behavior and overreaction at all provocations. In the case of people with narcissistic personality disorder, they do believe they're entitled. They do believe they're better. They do believe that there are reasons they should be above or at least outside of criticism. When they come to therapists at all, it's rarely because they've gotten there on their own. It's typically because they've been pushed there. And once they're there, they don't last very long. Narcissists are the ones who, faster than any other person with a personality disorder, will fire the shrink because they'll decide, I know better than the shrink. And the thing is, I'm probably smarter than the shrink. Then they go right back and they repeat the same thing. Now, there can be a learning curve for narcissists. It comes when the third marriage has failed. It comes when you've been fired from the third job. It comes when you realize that the circle of people who will tolerate you are beginning to shrink because they've all caught wise to who you are. In those cases, some people do say, I don't have things in my life that my other friends have, and I want to find a way to get them. But that typically happens when they're a little bit older, when life's handed them a few more setbacks. And also, as with all psychological disorders, symptoms tend to mellow a bit with age.
We have an email here from Jeff who wants to know, do narcissists gravitate toward one another or do they repel each other? And what does a conversation between two of them sound like?
Well, it's a little like matter and antimatter. They mutually annihilate. It depends on the circumstances. There actually is a school of thought, and I spoke to a number of researchers about this. It said romantic relationships between two narcissists actually can work sometimes because while neither of them is terribly capable of giving, neither one of them expects much anyway. They both just need the room to do their act. They both just need the room to perform and be seen and be adored. And if they're both talented and both charismatic and both happen to be gorgeous, well, that's great. Then the whole is better than the sum of the parts. And the couple as a whole gets even more attention. I'm not saying this is what Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are like, but one of the reasons people are transfixed by them is because they're both stunning and they're both charismatic. So the couple gets more recognition. Typically, they don't gravitate towards one another, though, because the person who needs to perform also needs an audience. And the person who can tolerate a narcissist also doesn't need to perform that much. To the extent that anyone can forge a close relationship with a narcissist, it's usually a very self-contained person who is like a camel, has a lot of onboard self-esteem and doesn't need so much from the outside, or at least doesn't need it from a partner or a close friend.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Cheryl on the line in Dallas. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm calling because I've been married to my husband for the last 22 years and had to suffer with a mother-in-law that is a complete narcissist. Never been able to have a conversation with her. It's only about her. But my question is about the effects it has on the kids and the family. My husband's not a narcissist. He's a pleaser. And it's really been hard for him in his life to always live up to her expectations.
Well, some narcissists, and I don't know your mother-in-law, so I don't pretend to speak from authority here, but some narcissists will live by proxy through their kids. Now, all parents do this to an extent, but a narcissistic parent will have an even greater need to see the child achieve, to see the child be recognized, because for the narcissistic parent, this is their secondhand way of getting that recognition themselves. Now, again, all parents do this. We beam at our kids when our kids achieve things. We show off pictures from our kids because at some level it reflects well on us. But if you are incapable of tolerating when your child doesn't do well, when your child doesn't look gorgeous, when your child isn't the most entertaining person in the room, that means that this has become entirely about you as opposed to you as a secondary beneficiary of your child's excellence. And that feels a lot more like, I need it, I want it, I must have it now, and since I'm not getting this recognition, this little emissary of me is going to go out and get it. Can that lead to the child feeling, I'm never good enough, I'm never accomplishing enough? Absolutely, because the parent is that hungry, that ravenous for recognition, that the child will never be able to fill the hole that's there because the parent couldn't fill it herself anyway.
I feel like maybe that the movie Gypsy should be shown to all first-year psychology students, and that can be their unit on narcissistic personality disorder.
Well, that's right. It's
proxy.
You know, it's like by proxy. People talk about Munchausen's by proxy, parents who keep bringing their kids into hospitals and pretending that they have symptoms of diseases rather than coming in hypochondriacally themselves. It's the same thing here. It's narcissism by proxy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. I have a quick comment and a quick question. So the comment I have is, in the past, you know, we've had some very progressive presidents that have done a lot for this country, but they were obviously hugely narcissistic. How do we, if we're constantly telling them, well, you know, if we're constantly telling society not to be too narcissistic, what about all the future people, possibly presidents, that we're preventing from becoming great people or becoming great people in history? And secondly, how do you become the editor of a major magazine and promote a book without being narcissistic?
Well, there are a couple answers.
That's a loaded
First of all,
question.
I'm not the there's a lot there. I'm not the editor of Time. I am an editor of Time. But let's start with the presidents first. I actually devote an entire chapter of the book to this. It's called The Peacock in the Oval Office. And narcissism in the case of presidents is sort of just the table stakes to play the game. You must be a raging narcissist to be president, because basically you're looking out at the country and saying, there are 317 million people living here. And you know who's better qualified than anyone else to lead them? Me. I once asked Al Gore that I saw him he spoke at an event in New York, and during the question and answer session, this was in 2008 when there was still a constituency in the Democratic Party for him to run for president. And I said, you know, if you felt like you were the one person best qualified to effectuate the changes you think are necessary, wouldn't you feel compelled to run? And he kind of laughed and he said, yeah, but that's what everybody thinks and decides before they run for president. There have been the narcissistic personality inventory was administered sort of third hand to presidents in one study that I love, and it looked at all the presidents from Washington up through Reagan. There was none after that. And virtually all of them blew the doors off the scale for the rest of us. The average was several points above the average for Americans as a whole, and the most narcissistic president scored a 35. That, you will be disappointed to learn, was a dark horse. It was Chester A. Arthur, who in his time was known as the dude of the White House. He owned 80 pairs of pants and changed his clothes 3 times a day. For me, working in a magazine and promoting a book, yes, I mean, ironically and sort of playfully, I do have a dedication in the book, and I dedicate it to myself. now, I mean that as a bit of a joke, but sure, if I didn't, or anyone who does anything publicly at all, if you didn't have an appetite for it, if you didn't have a certain need for recognition, you wouldn't go out and do it. And this applies to people in less high-profile fields than mine and more high-profile than mine. If you didn't have that need, that appetite, that desire for recognition, you wouldn't go out and do it. But keeping it balanced by celebrating other people's accomplishments, which I like to think I do, And by being humble enough to know there are a whole lot of authors out there, there are a whole lot of athletes out there, there are a whole lot of movie stars out there, and we're all transient and we'll all be dust soon anyway. When you maintain those kinds of perspective, it helps you climb down from whatever peak you're feeling at the moment.
I want to talk about social media. Lots of people are using things like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I feel like I can tell the difference between people who are on there all the time but are not very narcissistic and those who are. But there are other people who argue that anyone who spends time on social media is sort of flirting with developing a raging case of narcissism.
Well, I try to let social media off the hook a little bit in this book. Yes, there may be 1.1 billion people on Facebook currently and closing in on 100 million people on Twitter at the moment. But the arc of narcissism, the rise of narcissism in this country actually began in the late 70s and had really exploded by 2004, which was the year, funnily enough, Facebook was founded, but it was still in a dorm room at Harvard. And narcissism at that point was driven mostly as an unintended consequence of the self-esteem movement, which is a very good movement, by the way. There were a lot of kids who were marginalized because they weren't pretty or because they had learning disabilities or whatever else it was, who are now taught that they have an intrinsic value and that in many ways they're just, most ways, all ways that count, they're just as good as anyone else. But that also gave rise to the ethos of the everyone's a winner, everyone gets a medal at the track meet, or, you know, they're, I don't know, 12,000 self-esteem books. I actually have the number in my book. I've forgotten what it is on Amazon. And 300 of them are directed at the toddler crowd, when kids think they're at the center of the universe anyway. So Facebook is just sort of a potentiator. Twitter is just a potentiator of this. It's just something that exacerbates this trend. But you're right. There are people who, even in that context, even on that grading, correcting for the curve of Twitter and Facebook, are more narcissistic than other people. They're more exhibitionistic than other people. They never ask. They always show. They post only the best pictures of themselves. They post dozens and dozens of times a day, and it's generally about boasting as opposed to sharing or inquiring or engaging. So you can spot people who are more narcissistic than others on Facebook. And there's some studies about this that I cite in my book. But that doesn't mean that we're all flirting with narcissism just because we like Facebook and Twitter.
So we may have the ability to avoid narcissists in our social lives, but we can't necessarily avoid them at, say, family reunions or certainly in the workplace. What do we do to coexist with these folks?
Well, the first thing we do is try to remember that it's not about us. The person who always talks about himself would be doing that whether he was talking to you or talking to someone else. The person who cannot abide hearing about your success without saying, yes, but mine is bigger, is the exact same way with everybody else in the workplace. It's important to try to embrace and accept what narcissists do well in the workplace, which is generally that they will be the energizer at the beginning of a project. They'll be the ones with the best ideas very often at the beginning of a project. They'll certainly be the ones who go into a meeting and sell the idea well. They're, you know, Don Draper in Mad Men, or the Tom Cruise character when he played the sports agent, the master of the living room, he called himself. It's good to have a narcissist in that situation. So be happy, be grateful for them around you. It's much worse when you've won the account, when you've got your sports client and you've gotten him his contract. Then it's the day-to-day lower profile managing of the work that you've won, and that's where narcissists tend to slack off because there's no opportunity for glory.
Got to jump in because we're out of time. Jeffrey
Kluger.
Oh,
I'm so sorry. I don't mean to ramble.
Oh, that's all right. It's great. He's editor-at-large at timeandtime.com. His new book is The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Eric Bright. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.